You're listening to Arrivé by the Cycling Podcast.
Good evening, Lionel.
Good evening, Daniel. Or afternoon. It's still quite early.
It's very early. You've barely had your, what do you have, your tea cakes for lunch? I don't know. Your malt loaf. afternoon tea. Lionel, not a dry eye in the house. A dry edition of Paris-Roubaix, which is my favourite flavour because I'm a contrarian. But not a dry eye in the house. Very emotional Paris-Roubaix and a pulsating Paris-Roubaix as well. It's always pulsating. But as it often is, I find, particularly when it is dry and fast, it seems to sort of whip up. It seems to crank up the excitement levels and sort of spread them out over the course of the day, maybe to a greater extent than the wet editions, than the fated wet editions.
Yeah, there's a sense that you don't get any time to take your eyes off the screen, really. I think I was messaging our friend and colleague Ed Pickering, and at one point I realised that I was hungry. I hadn't eaten since the start.
No malt loaf.
Terrible. No malt loaf, no. And I'd needed a wee since Orchy, and we were heading towards the Carrefour de l'Arbre at that point, just because it was such a full-on edition of the race, wasn't it? And like you say, the quick ones with the tailwind. I remember the one 2007 when Stuart O'Grady won, and they'd had a tailwind, and he'd been in the early break, and they were flying along. Got caught and then got away again. There was just that sense of there isn't a moment to pause. The race didn't really settle down into any sort of pattern until the two riders got clear. And then I suppose the great paradox of professional cycling at the moment is that if you switched on with an hour and a half to go, you probably experience a very different race to the one that I experienced having watched from start to finish, because honestly, I think it was one of the most absorbing, the most dramatic, the most exciting, and plenty of suspense in there as well. It was a fantastic race. One of the best I've ever seen, I think.
And with a final result and a winner full of pathos, I would suggest, very much a redemptive final result. But we'll get to that. We won't even mention him yet. Usually we do. Usually we spoiler it straight away. I'm assuming everyone listening to this knows who has won already. But Lionel, it was the first ever edition of Paris-Roubaix Hauts de France.
Oh, goodness me.
There had been 122 editions of the previous incarnation, formerly known as Paris-Roubaix.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to catch on for us, is it? It's just Paris-Roubaix, the hell of the north, the queen of the classics. It doesn't need a name bolted on, does it? It's the greatest one-day race in the world. I think all of the sort of cliches about it are grounded in truth. It's the only day of the year where the riders will carry on to the velodrome, even if they know they're going to be outside the time limit, because they want to finish the race. They want to be a survivor of hell. It's a race where, you've made your comment there about the wet weather editions. I do enjoy a good wet weather edition of Paris-Roubaix, but it really doesn't matter, because every edition of Paris-Roubaix is, to a degree, unpredictable, exciting. There's storylines all throughout the day. And well, today's race was a very, very vintage example, I would say.
You've just said it is the most exciting, or the greatest one-day bike race. We're correcting ourselves on a fortnightly basis now, aren't we? Because we said that about Milan San Remo a couple of weeks ago. But give it 10 days, we'll be calling Fleshwell on the greatest race in Britain, the greatest show on earth.
Maybe we will. I mean, we're living through quite a spectacular era because of the riders. But I think there's something about Paris-Roubaix that is so anachronistic, isn't it? If it were invented today, everybody would be complaining. It's too dangerous. The cobbles are too extreme. Too much bad luck comes to the fore. And I mean, we saw that today. It was a race of luck and punctures and problems and chasing. You know, it's really the absolute opposite of what a lot of people get from professional cycling, which is they want to see the strongest rider win. And that doesn't necessarily turn out to be the case in Paris-Roubaix. And yet, you know, you cannot say that the winner does not deserve to stand on the top step of the podium and lift up the cobblestone and take it back to Flanders with him.
To Flanders. There you go. You've killed the suspense, Lionel. You've ended our guessing game. We will, at this point, we will tell you that Wout van Aert did win the first ever edition of Paris-Roubaix Hauts de France. Lionel, I was in an aeroplane for the first couple of hours of the race, but the peloton was, well, they seemed to be sort of piloting their own aeroplane and the speed that they were going. Just tell me and tell the listeners what happened. So I sort of tuned in with about 150 kilometres to go. Tell us what happened, certainly in the first 100 kilometres or so, if you will.
I will do. I mean, not a lot if you wanted to just sort of summarise the incidents. But oddly, professional cycling, again, is a sport where the drama ramps up in a race like this when the less happens, basically. I mean, it was an incredibly fast start. I think they covered the first 10 kilometres at an average speed of 57 kilometres an hour. They were still well over 55k an hour for the first hour. There was no real break to talk about. There was just a sort of mini split that got clear with 250k to go. It had Rassenberg of Unibet, Govicar of Bahrain and Sheehan of NSN. They were briefly joined by Case Boll as well, but within a dozen kilometres they were caught. The peloton split into two parts with around 190k to go. Tadej Pogacar was at the back of the second group at that stage. I mean, it wasn't sort of panic stations because it was always going to come back together. But the 100 and so kilometres to the first section of cobbles at Trois-Villes, they were kind of event-free, really, but they were fast and they were hard and no one was getting any headway at the front of the peloton. It was just a gradual kind of ratcheting up of the tension. And when they approached Trois-Villes, it was Ineos Grenadiers who led onto the pavé. Josh Tarling was the first man onto the cobbles. Mike Tournison, former yellow jersey at the Tour de France when he rode for Visma, or Jumbo Visma as they were then, he's now riding for XDS Astana, of course. He got a little gap, and for a moment, he had Stefan Bissiger of Decathlon on his wheel, but Bissiger decided not to go with that move. Tournison was caught shortly afterwards, and then came the first of what was an incredible number of mechanical issues for the biggest riders. 158k to go, Mads Pedersen had a problem. 145 kilometres to go, Wout van Aert had a puncture. And at this stage, UAE Team Emirates were riding the absolute perfect race. They had Morgado, Vermeersch, Bjerg, Pollitt and Pogacar all at the front, taking up the first five positions on the front of the peloton. 139 kilometres to go, there was another big split in the peloton. In the front group, there was a crash shortly afterwards for Turner and Tarling of Ineos Grenadiers and Ballerini of XDS Astana. And then Sector 22, with 121 kilometres to go, the first defining moment of the race, which was the puncture for Tadej Pogacar. Now, he was riding there in the wheels of his teammates, but none of his teammates slowed down with him to either swap a bike or a wheel. Initially, it looked very confident, looked like he was totally in control, knew what he was doing. But as he drifted back and stopped on the side of the road, it became apparent that the UAE Team Emirates car was miles back. So he took one of the blue Shimano neutral service bikes and got on and was caught by this second part of the peloton. And so he was out of position quite dramatically at that stage. The front group didn't really press on dramatically. It wasn't until after Sector 21 that Pogacar finally got service from his UAE Team Emirates team car. By that time, he was about 49 seconds behind. He had Morgado for company, and then eventually Pollitt and Bjerg sat up and drifted back to the second group, leaving just Florian Vermeersch up front for UAE. And that was kind of like the first big bit of drama. Pogacar riding to limit his losses, and then eventually, after the section at Haveloy, Sector 20, Pogacar got back on after, what, a 20-kilometre chase.
20 kilometres, yeah.
Yeah.
It was around about...
In the meantime, Al Pacin had ridden on the front at Haveloy, and Vanderpool did a sort of teasing acceleration just to make it that little bit harder, I think, for Pogacar to finally close the gap. But 98K to go, they were all kind of back together and barreling towards Arenberg.
Yeah, the gap, Pogacar's gap was around about a minute and it came down pretty quickly to 20 seconds, but it was those sort of last 20 seconds he was struggling. Paradoxically, when he had teammates, he was really struggling to close, and that sort of reflects the fact that, as you say, they'd accelerated at the front, Alpecin Premier Tech, for briefly at that point, but he did get back on right at the moment. It was almost as though he'd sort of put out the fire in his house, but then flooded it in the process, because as he got back on, then they arrived at the Arenberg Forest, and he really had no choice at that point, did he, but to go right to the front and sort of continue prolonging his effort. And it was all sort of one movement, the chase and then straight to the front with Florian Vermeers, who had not dropped back noticeably at all. And he then took Pogacar to the front, and as I say, they arrived in the Arenberg Forest.
It was reminiscent, wasn't it, of the timing of his crash in Milan-San Remo, when he got back on just in time for the big crucial part of the race, the Cipressa. He got back into position at Arenberg really just in time. Van Aert was the rider setting the pace at the front through Arenberg. Pogacar was back in, you know, good position just in time. But the question at this stage was, what kind of cost would that effort have taken from him? And that was what we were speculating about, I suppose, in our heads. I mean, I was watching alone, so I was having a conversation with myself. Until the next, and arguably the more dramatic incident, which was the puncture for Mathieu van der Poel, the defending champion, won three in a row, really had very little bad luck in Paris-Roubaix. But the puncture he had, the timing of it was absolutely catastrophic, really. Full gas over the Arenberg. And initially, Jasper Philipsen gave him his bike, but that was no good. I couldn't work out what was going wrong for van der Poel there. He didn't seem to be able to get his shoes into the pedals properly. That seemed to be the issue initially.
Yeah, I don't know whether he'd got mud on his cleats or something and couldn't get in, or he decided that it wasn't the best, you know, the right fit for him after all. Or it was a bit, I mean, we glossed over the fact that Pogacar as well, when he took the neutral service bike, he was offered a wheel, sort of waved that away, didn't take it. And there was a similar sort of confusion. It was kind of reminiscent of the Visma Lisa bike, or the Jumbo Visma, then fiasco in the cobbled stage of the Tour de France three years ago. It was Vingegaard taking Nathan van Hooijdonk's bike, wasn't it? And sort of, right, I think Christophe Laporte standing on the side of the road holding a wheel and it being a complete fiasco. And it was sort of reminiscent of that. At one stage, Van der Poel was sort of walking up the Arenberg Forest, then he was coming back down, then he was trying to fix it himself. And then what happened? Did he take another teammate's bike? What was the bike that he eventually got on?
Didn't Del Grosso swap wheels
put his wheel
in Van der Poel's bike, and then Van der Poel was able to get away again? Yeah, I mean, who would have had on their bingo card of Paris-Roubaix the sight of Van der Poel walking the wrong way down the Arenberg Forest? Incredible drama. The thing that this kind of, the consequence of this was that we didn't really see what else played out on and directly after Arenberg among the lead group. But really the story at the time was all about Van der Poel, because the race was getting away from him. He was very quickly a minute and 20 seconds down. And then, unbelievably, he had another puncture before he'd even got off the cobbles at Arenberg. And by the time he got going again and onto the smooth road, the gap was 2 minutes. And I have to say, at that stage, I thought it was, you know, game over for him.
It did. It felt like that to me as well. But on the other hand, I was also thinking, you know, he was the sort of wardrobe monster in the horror film that needs to be killed off, because otherwise, 5 minutes before the end, the door's going to swing open and he's going to appear with a huge scythe. And that almost happened.
Well, the one question I wanted to ask you, Daniel, was the little acceleration that Van der Poel made on the cobbles at Haveloy, which just made it that little bit harder for Pogacar to get back on. I mean, give them credit, they didn't really capitalise on Pogacar's misfortune, did they? But that little acceleration, was this a case of karma being served, you know, sort of boomeranging back into Vanderpool's face within, what, half a dozen kilometres?
Yeah, that was a strange move, that, wasn't it? Because, as you say, it seemed, he seemed to be trying to make sure that Pogacar wasn't going to get back on before Arenberg. But then we cut to the director, cut to the overhead shot shortly thereafter, and you saw that the momentum had completely gone out of the front group, and Pogacar actually made it back, bridged those last 15, 20 seconds really easily. I mean, in a race like Paris-Roubaix, often you're basing your sort of impression on who's doing what on the time gaps, and that phase of the race that you talked about where Pogacar was off the back, Alpes and Premiatep were on the front. I think most of the commentators, whether it was on, you know, UK commentary or French TV, agreed with you, said that they were, okay, they were riding, Alpes and were riding, but maybe not sort of foot to the floor. But it's hard to tell sometimes, isn't it, exactly how hard the various groups are going, and whether, you know, we're going to come on to this in a second, but the phase after Arenberg, where Mads Pedersen seemed to be, you know, he was riding, he was coming through, but his turns seemed to be a lot shorter, and there seemed to be not quite as many watts going through the pedals as was the case from Pogacar and the other riders in that group.
Yeah, very possibly. I mean, once they'd come off the Arenberg cobbles, the lead group was, oh, I mean, it was a pretty impressive group, wasn't it? It was Tadej Pogacar, Mads Pedersen, it was Wout van Aert and Christophe Laporte, teammates, of course, Visma Lisa bike. It was Bissiger, Jasper Stuyven and Laurens Pithy. And I guess one of the riders that had missed out at that stage was Filippo Ganna. He rode across with Jordi Meus of Red Bull on his wheel. And there was this extraordinary passage from about 82K to go to 78K to go. Ganna got up to the lead group, very shortly afterwards punctured. Then Meus was dropped, and then Laurens Pithy, his Red Bull teammate, punctured. So the state of flux in that front group and behind was quite remarkable. I mean, talk about misfortune for riders at the worst possible time. Pogacar then had a bike change just before the cobbles at Tilloy, and then Wout van Aert had a bike change as well. Pogacar got back much more quickly than van Aert did. I think Pogacar took 3 or 4 kilometres at that stage to get back on, whereas van Aert was chasing for 10K with the Red Bull pair that had, well, Meus, I think his legs had deserted him temporarily, and Pithy had the puncture. They got back on with about 61K to go. And while all this was happening, Van der Poel had ridden himself back up to the Ganna group, and they had a little conversation about how do we close this gap, because, well, Ganna had a couple of teammates in there, Ben Turner and Connor Swift. And so there was a chance there for Van der Poel to bring the gap down from, well, at this stage, it was about 1:07 still.
And Lionel, you mentioned Wout van Aert coming back. That was, so I think he made it back with 60 kilometres to go. So that was just before the Oshi sector. And his first attack, in fact, Wout van Aert's really his only attack in the whole race was on the asphalt just before Oshi. But then the pressure remained on, and it was mainly Pogacar that was forcing the pace, I think, on that sector. And that would eventually dislodge Mads Pedersen, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there. That was the race, really, wasn't it? Pogacar and van Aert were away at that stage. Pedersen couldn't hold the pace. And behind, still more drama, because Ganna got dropped by the Van der Poel group, punctured, was riding on a flat tyre, got thrown off on a left-hand corner. You know, that was his day, more or less done. But Van der Poel was still riding at this stage, I thought. He hadn't given up the ghost, had he? But he also wasn't panicking. He was just, you know, almost Jaws-like, making his way back, you know, very, very gradually, or perhaps not trying to spook or startle anyone further up the road into sort of, you know, panicking and maybe making the chase harder for himself. And then 50K to go, Van der Poel, they joined up with the Bissiger and Laporte group. And I don't know what you thought at this stage, Daniel, but I thought that 48.5K to go, or whatever it is, Mons-en-Pévèle, one of the hardest sections of cobbles in the race, I thought that was where Pogacar would try and make a decisive move. And he did put Van Aert briefly in difficulty, but it wasn't quite enough, was it?
No, and well, that would be the case for over the next, well, until the Cofol de l'Arbre, we'll get to that. But, he would occasionally get sort of a bike length or maybe even slightly more than a bike length. And there were numerous accelerations. There was even the acceleration, I think it was on the false flat coming out of Mont-Saint-Pavel, which is one of the, in the last sort of 100 kilometres of the race, there's very little elevation to speak of. But that is one point where the road does climb slightly, and he did accelerate there, and there was a moment where the camera was sort of front on, and we saw Van Aert sort of shaking his head behind, as if to say, you know, give me a break.
Yeah, still at this point the gap to the Van der Poel group was sort of coming down to sort of 40 seconds, then down to 30 seconds as they were approaching Camphaunt on Pavel, which is sector 5. You know, the race really settled into a bit of a pattern at this stage, didn't it? I think everyone was waiting for that one last big effort. Maybe it would be Van der Poel trying to ride across on the Cofol de l'Arbre if he could get close enough. Maybe it would be Pogacar trying to ride away from Van Aert on the same section. I think by this stage, I don't know what you thought, Daniel, but it seemed to me that Pogacar was running out of opportunities and that Van Aert was looking increasingly confident about going to the velodrome with Pogacar and relying on his sprint.
Yeah, and we knew there were two difficult sections to come. So Camphaunt en Pavel and then the Cofol de l'Arbre. And they come in quick succession, sort of 20 kilometres to go and about 17, 18 kilometres to go. And I don't know if you thought this was significant, Lionel, but the Visma Lisa bike team car came up to Van Aert. And I don't know whether they gave him the instruction at that point to stop working, even just for the next phase, those next two cobbled sectors, or on the way into those next two cobbled sectors, because it was clear that those were going to be Pogacar's last throw of the dice. And that's what he did. For five kilometers there, he stopped coming through with Pogacar. And they were both sort of playing a bit of a dangerous game, because Van der Poel's group's deficit wasn't really changing. They were never really completely out of range. You could have imagined a scenario where Van Aert and Pogacar started to play around a little bit in the last few kilometres and someone could have made it across. And in fact, they got very close. But Lionel, Cofol de l'Arbre, it was the last sort of swing of the bat from Pogacar. And
yeah, he almost slid out on a corner, didn't he?
Yeah, and you know, I was watching French TV and they were pretty convinced, certainly Laurent Jalabert, who we established his credentials to talk about Paris-Roubaix. Well, he's got more credentials than us, but he was no Paris-Roubaix expert. In fact, I looked up his results in Paris-Roubaix. He read it three times early in his career. But anyway, he's a pretty fine commentator. He strongly felt that slide out by Pogacar came just as he was actually snapping the elastic. I'm not convinced. I still think that Van Aert had enough in the tank to make it back. He would have made it back eventually, got onto Pogacar's wheel, and it would have been impossible to get him off Pogacar's wheel. But I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was where he was trying to make the difference, but I don't think he would have made the difference. I think Van Aert would have dug in and got back on. I think it was notable from that point on just how close to Pogacar's wheel Van Aert would ride when he was in second place. I mean, I was watching through my fingers a bit on sector 3, Grusson, which is not the hardest, but it's the final it's a hard enough section before they get to the streets of Roubaix. And I mean, it was almost, you know, rubber on rubber on the back wheel of Pogacar and the front wheel of Van Aert. So close, overlapping a little bit. I think the wind was coming from the left at that stage. So Van Aert was really, really alert, very attentive to make sure that it didn't even lose, you know, a wheel length, because that might have been the moment. And he really won it there, I thought, especially when they came off that section and Pogacar was on the front and he flicked his elbow and Van Aert just rolled through really kind of smooth, almost casual. And he seemed to sort of grow in confidence from that point on, I felt. It looked like Pogacar was kind of out of cards at that stage. And I mean, two up sprint in the velodrome at the end of a race that fast, that long, you know, it's never going to be a gimme. But I felt that Van Aert's sort of the way he'd ridden, the fact that he hadn't had to do quite as much in terms of chasing, probably was going to play into his favour in the velodrome. And so it proved, really. But the jump from Van Aert with half a lap to go, I mean, it was what? It was years of frustration and sort of built up expectation and this kind of the weight of the great Flandrian of the era who hasn't won a Tour of Flanders, hasn't won a Paris-Roubaix. Yes, he's won Milan-San Remo, but it was the summer edition after the lockdown, wasn't it? Which felt a little bit strange even at the time. You know, he's won again Wevelgem and an E3 Saxo Classic, but hasn't landed a real big, true Flandrian classic. And it looked like all of that frustration, all of that desire was wrapped up in that one moment where he opened up quite a significant gap to Pogacar, who I think was just on his last legs. I mean, incredible ride by him, but he didn't react quickly enough when the sprint opened up.
Yeah, and I'm sure he wouldn't have wanted to come into the velodrome on the front and have to lead out the sprint. But once you have, I mean, you're not going to find many guys as experienced as Van Aert who are going to come through and give you another turn if you're on the front coming into the velodrome. And I thought that Pogacar would try and go for a really long one. It actually ended up being quite a short sprint. And you always suspected that that would suit Van Aert more than Pogacar with the jump that he has. And it was sort of vintage Van Aert, wasn't it? A sort of version of Van Aert that we maybe don't see quite as much these days, or haven't seen as much in the last few years. I mean, just looking at his palmarès and the victories that he has taken over the last couple of years, it really is a case of quality replacing quantity. I mean, you think of the two big wins last year in the Strade Bianche stage of the Giro and then the Montmartre stage of the Tour de France. He's really the last person to drop, if you discount Remco Evenepoel, who passed Pogacar in the World Time Trial Championship. He's the last person to really drop Pogacar and comprehensively beat him in a road race, and that was in the last stage of the Tour last year. So, he's really become a big match player, but there's a lot more to say about Van Aert, isn't there?
There is, yeah, not least that his last three attempts at Paris-Roubaix have been comparatively getting worse, because his record is second, third and fourth. Last year he was fourth, so he seemed to be getting further away from victory. But, it's a bit like laying off in a sprint, isn't it? Lull everyone into a false sense of security. And that sort of run of results almost mirrored the way he jumped and came past Pogacar at the finish to clinch what is, I think, probably the biggest and most illustrious win of his career.
And it was an excellent day for the Belgians, Lionel, because they also claimed third place. We didn't mention that Jasper Stuyven from the Van der Poel group, he managed to sneak away in the last, was it about 3 or 4 kilometres from the finish? And he wasn't caught, so he narrowly took that third place ahead of the Van der Poel group. Van der Poel himself was fourth. Christophe Laporte, who was sort of on sentry duty, I suppose, for Van Aert in that group behind for a long time, he was fifth. Mick van Dijk of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe was sixth, Mads Pedersen seventh, and a very good ride by Stefan Bissiger as well. He was eighth for Decathlon. The next group was a long way down, and that was Niels Pollitt and Mike Tournison. So they rounded out the top 10, ninth and 10th, respectively. Any other names you'd like to pick out, Lionel? Just going down, obviously, I mean, the race has been finished almost an hour now. 139 finishers, as we often say, as we sort of notoriously say, this is a race that generally riders will kind of bust a gut to finish. And I can see, Alistair McKellar there outside the time limit, EF Education, Easy Post, not sure what time limit was, but Benjamin Thomas of Cofidis is currently the last finisher, 139th place, 24 minutes, 31 seconds down.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode of Arrivé is sponsored by NordVPN, which is the best and fastest virtual private network in the world. We're in the thick of the classic season. The Giro d'Italia is coming up, then the Tour de France. Maybe you're planning a trip. And if you're doing so, a subscription to NordVPN will help to keep all of your connections safe and secure when you're browsing the internet on your phone or tablet or laptop when you are off abroad traveling around. It's also important to look after your internet connections when you're at home, and a NordVPN subscription will do that for you. It's very, very easy to use. You just download NordVPN and then choose your location. And once NordVPN is activated, you know that all of your internet connections are safe and secure. You're protected from viruses, phishing attempts, malware, and all of the data that you transmit across the internet is safe and secure. So things like passwords, the login details for your bank account, and that kind of thing, all protected by NordVPN. There are other benefits too, not least that you can switch your location when you're away and carry on watching your favourite sports events or streaming services as if you were at home. And because you listen to the Cycling Podcast, you can get a great discount on a subscription. Go to nordvpn.com/TCP. If you sign up for a 2-year plan, you'll get 4 months extra for free. That's at nordvpn.com/TCP. It's risk-free too with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee.
Well, Lionel, I said a redemptive victory for Wout van Aert. He didn't need to morally redeem himself, but it's redemptive in the sense that he has had a lot of bad luck over the last few years, hasn't he? And he has sort of, well, I talked about the pathos of Wout van Aert, and he's sort of become the popular champion or the popular hero because of all the bad luck he's suffered. But also, I think, because of the narrative that has been built, and it also reflects reality of his rivalry with Mathieu van der Poel. And as the years have gone by, the gulf between their respective palmares has grown wider and wider. And I think there's obviously a lot of sort of sympathy for Van Aert for that reason, as well as the fact that he's someone who generally has carried himself with sort of grace and dignity and a certain degree of stoicism as well. He's continued to bounce back, and he's continued to dig deep and sort of pull out those big wins that I mentioned before the break. Even though, by most people's estimates, he's maybe not quite been the same rider that he was in his sort of 2021 peak.
Yeah, I mean, he'd become cast as sort of the nearly man, hadn't he? Mm. So many thirds and fourth places in major classics. And if we just take the last couple of classics campaigns, I mean, last year he conspired to lose the Doise d'Or Vlaanderen to Nielsen Paulus. I mean, he was mugged really at the finish there, wasn't he? I mean, almost in comedy fashion. It was, and the sort of narrative was of, you know, what does Wout van Aert need to do to win? Then he was fourth in Flanders, fourth in Paris-Roubaix, fourth in the Amstel Gold Race. And it just starting to look like he'd been so totally eclipsed by Van der Poel and now Pogacar in races that really should belong to a rider of Wout van Aert's nationality and also, you know, his skill set. And then this year, you know, third in Milan-San Remo was a very good result, but it wasn't a victory. Doise d'Or Vlaanderen caught on the line by Filippo Ganna. Tour Flanders, best rider not to make it onto the podium. So it does feel redemptive today. The big, big victory that his career sort of needed, really. He's got a cobblestone trophy to take back home with him. And, you know, he can legitimately say he's one of the greats of modern day classic riding in an era that has been totally dominated by Mathieu van der Poel and Tadej Pogacar, to the extent that really there are some days when it feels like everyone's racing for third anyway.
Yeah, and early in the race, I mean, I said earlier I didn't see the first hour or two, but early in the race, things seemed to be pointing in a sort of familiar and kind of disappointing direction for Visma Lisabike, just in the sense that the one of the things that's been levelled at Van Aert for the last couple of years has been that maybe he's lost a bit of confidence because of the crashes, and he doesn't have quite the same appetite for fighting at the front of a bunch in these races that he maybe once had and that you maybe once need and that we see from other riders. And around about, or just before the time when Pogacar had his mechanical, So the first sectors of cobbles, Visma, Lisa Bike, they had four riders, I think, shortly after, maybe in the sort of second sector of cobbles, they were left with four riders, and they were sort of scattered everywhere. They had Matthew Brennan, Wout van Aert, Christophe Laporte, and they had Per Strand Hagenes as well, who then suffered some kind of mechanical problem, and we never saw him again. And it did look as though that maybe Visma and Lisa Bike were falling into traps that they've fallen into a little bit more often than they or their fans would have liked over the last couple of years. But, you know, luck played such a big part today, and it always does. I would suggest that of the sort of big three, Van der Poel, Pogacar and Van Aert, although he did have his share of bad luck and mechanical problems, he probably had slightly less than the other two. It wasn't quite as crippling as it was for the other two. Well, less so for Pogacar, but certainly Van der Poel.
Yeah, I mean, timing was everything, wasn't it? Van Aert's first major problem was 145k to go when there was plenty of time to recover, and it was still, although there was a split in the peloton that came, he was never really put in too much difficulty. And, of course, he had Christophe Laporte always there in the front. I mean, there was that phase with around 65k to go where the leading five was Pogacar, Pedersen, Laporte, Bissiger and Sturven. And this was the point where Van Aert was chasing back on after his second major mechanical puncture, whichever it was. So, you know, he always had somebody up there alongside him. And of course, Laporte's sprint is, you know, good, very good. I mean, if they'd gone to the velodrome in a bigger group, Laporte might well have been the one to work for in the sprint finish. So they had that kind of insurance policy. And even when Van der Poel was kind of reuniting all these groups behind, Hagenes for Visma Lisa Bike was in there just sitting tight and waiting to see whether that group would you know, get any closer. So they rode, you know, given that there's so much that luck can play a part in a race like Paris-Roubaix, especially on a day like today when it was so fast that every problem was just kind of magnified, wasn't it? You know, the time gaps seemed to sort of go up exponentially. So even just pausing to answer the call of nature was fraught with risk at certain points today. But Van Aert managed to plot his way round very comfortably. And I thought he looked like his confidence was growing in that final phase when it was just him and Pogacar, because all of the onus really was on Pogacar. Yes, Van Aert would have been thinking, this is a fantastic opportunity, don't let it slip through the fingers. But Pogacar was there aiming to make history that may never come round again. He could have been the first man to hold all five monuments as defending champion at the same time. That's never been done before. No man has won all five monuments in their career since Roger de Vlaeminck in 77. Only Eddy Merckx and Rick Van Looy have done it. You know, we haven't had a Tour de France champion win Paris-Roubaix since Bernardino in 1981. No Grand Tour winner has won Paris-Roubaix since Sean Kelly in 1986. I mean, there were so many little historical things, not little historical things, major historical things that were on the line for Pogacar. Van Aert could afford to just play chicken with him a little bit and as you say, force Pogacar to ride on the front more. You would have thought, really, of the two, Van Aert would want to lead into the cobbles and pick his own line and all the rest of it. But he allowed Pogacar to lead onto so many of those later sections. And I think that was just a demonstration of that confidence.
Yeah, I don't know what social media was saying, but I think he got the balance perfectly right. I mentioned those moments, didn't I, where it wasn't as simple as he's going to work with Pogacar or he's not going to work with Pogacar. There were moments when he did and there were moments when he didn't. And of course, he had to balance that with what was behind and knowing that Van der Poel was on a bit of a charge, this remontada behind, knowing that he also had Laporte behind. So it was quite a sort of deft game that he had to play. I did fear that, you know, you remember, well, it's only a week ago, the Tour of Flanders, when on the penultimate time up the Quaremont, Van Aert looked really good, but then faded pretty quickly. I did fear that we might be seeing an action replay of that on Arenberg Forest when he looked like the strongest rider, but then on the subsequent cobbled sections, it looked as though Pogacar had him on the ropes a little bit. But then once he'd overcome, if that was a difficult moment, I mean, I guess he'll talk about it in his press conference afterwards, but as you say, Lionel, in the last sort of 40, 50 kilometres, if anything, my confidence in him was growing. With every sort of passing sector of cobbles, with every section of the race, we should mention. I mean, we said it was a very emotional, understandably emotional, given what he's been through. Embraces with his teammates, team manager Richard Plugger, and so on. It was a nice moment. I know us boomers hate it when when rivals kind of cuddle and, you know, congratulate each other after the finish, but you have to acknowledge that from Van der Poel, given their history, for Van der Poel to make a beeline for him, and given what Van der Poel had endured himself today, I thought that was a very noble moment, noble gesture, and one that people will remember. And it's a photograph that will, another of these photographs that will sort of encapsulate their rivalry, which for the most part has been a brilliant, exciting rivalry, but also one that's been sort of contested in the right spirit.
Yeah, Van der Poel was, I think, the first person to get to Van Aert to congratulate him, because he collapsed on the floor in tears.
Would we have preferred it if he'd stormed
off to the showers?
Yeah, if he'd thrown his helmet at him. That would have been good as well.
But no, I think that there's something about Paris-Roubaix, isn't it? It's sort of pugilism on bikes, isn't it? And this is the equivalent of heavyweights going 12 rounds, and the loser, you know, lifting the glove of the victor in the air at the finish, isn't it? I mean, Van der Poel did everything possible to win from an absolutely hopeless position, really. Mm-hmm. 2 minutes down at Arenberg. We have seen people come back from there, but not in these sort of circumstances where, you know, there wasn't a dud rider up the road for a start. That front group was packed with riders who were, you know, either world-class, absolutely world-class, or fully committed. Everybody was represented. So it wasn't like there was any opportunity for playing about, hesitation. You know, Van der Poel had to ride his way back into contention. And the fact that he rode himself into anything like contention, and that there was still that question when the gap was sort of 30 seconds coming to that very final phase of the race, was remarkable. Equally remarkable, really, was that it just all stayed as it was. It was a little bit like I was saying last week after the Tour of Flanders. You just know the level is so high when the gaps just aren't shifting. And it's another of these paradoxes of professional cycling, which is that you know, the drama would have been in a pursuit, in a catch, in it all coming back together again in time for the velodrome. But actually, the brilliance of these riders is that the two out in front were able to hold the gap as it was, and Van der Poel was able to, you know, get it as close as he could, but just couldn't quite close the door. I mean, again, you could look at that group, and we didn't see enough of it really to assess who was and wasn't working. But this is the difficulty, isn't it? All of those riders would have been thinking, third place is up for grabs here if I just sit on. And
with Laporte in there as well, who knows whether... I mean, it didn't strike me when we did see that group, it didn't strike me that his presence was disrupting things too much. But, you know, if they were just sort of... knocking off their effort by 1% or 0.5% because they knew that they weren't going to, or they didn't want to take Laporte to the finish, then that could have been decisive as well, because there was sort of an invisible wall around about, I feel that around about the sort of 20-second mark. If they'd got inside 20 seconds, then it would have been game on. But it always stayed, I think the lowest it got was about 22 seconds. And therefore, Pogacar and Van Aert never really felt too threatened. But, you know, you start to get to sort of 15 seconds, then that's one huge Van der Poel acceleration on a cobbled sector. And all of a sudden, he's back with them. But they just never got beyond, as I said, that sort of invisible wall.
I had my usual anxiety as they reached the velodrome that it would all go catastrophically wrong, and that the chasers would come that, into the velodrome.
Just hasn't it?
It has happened, yeah. And it's a mess, isn't it? I mean, there's almost an unwritten rule that the chase group don't join in on the back of the leaders in that circumstance, and that they ride a different line round the velodrome. But it just always gives me the fear, that possibility. You don't want to see a sort of, you know, I don't know, somebody touches a wheel and brings down the two leaders, or the race winner's crossing the line in a group, but he's fifth man over the line in that group, and oh my goodness, cycling's such a mess kind of moment. But it fortunately
imagine a scenario, and it's this: is this allowed? Could Christophe Laporte have given Wout van Aert a lead out if they'd timed it right?
You're testing me here.
I mean, surely yes.
I think in practice, yes, but is there something in the rules about that, in the UCI rules? We'll have to check it out before. I'm sure we've talked about this before. But yeah, Laporte flying into the velodrome and giving Van Aert a lead out. I don't think so. I think that would certainly be against the spirit of
it. It would be against the spirit, but I don't know how you could litigate against it. There's no provision for that.
Well, they're not in the same part of the course, are they? They're not on the same. They're literally not on the same part of the course. One is 500 or so meters ahead.
That's Thierry.
They're in the same. They're in the same space-time continuum, but they're not in the same place.
That's the course designer's fault. That's Thierry Gouvenou's fault. Another thing he's done wrong this weekend.
Maybe they need an adjacent velodrome next door for the second place group to ride into. But we're going into the realm of the absurd here, which I suppose we would have been had Tadej Pogacar won and completed this streak of monument wins. Nevertheless, an incredible performance from him, but the Grand Slam slips away, and you have to wonder, you know, last year he made an error and lost as a result, really, but otherwise rode a very good race. Very difficult to know what he could have done today differently, other than not have a puncture at not the worst time in the race, but at a point in time where he really had to burn quite a lot of energy to get back. And I don't think UAE Team Emirates necessarily, in hindsight, dealt with it as well as they might have been able to.
I don't think they did.
But in the heat of it, I thought it was extraordinary that at least one rider didn't slow down and stop with him straight away, immediately, and then sort it out from there, because they had numbers up there. They didn't need to sacrifice Vermeersch at that point. That's fine. But one of the others, maybe even two of the others, could have gone back, because it's quite obvious that UAE Team Emirates, their strategy was all for Pogacar. And then in that crucial moment, they weren't all for Pogacar. And maybe he said, it's okay, guys, I'll be fine. But even in that scenario, I think they should have taken that decision off him. I'm speculating here. I don't know what Pogacar said in that moment. But the fact that he then ended up on the Shimano bike, it was far from ideal. And it took a long time for him to get a replacement bike, and even longer to get back on. It was probably sort of the difference between having a bit more zip at the finish or being able to make a decisive move in the finale.
Yeah, I agree. I think he was in the wind after the mechanical. When he was on the neutral service bike, he was in the wind because no one was working with him for a significant amount of time. And it didn't even look as though, so it was Bjerg, wasn't it? And Pollitt, Pollitt seems to be remonstrating with Bjerg at one point, sort of saying, look, we've got to wait now. But by this point, Pogacar had been off the back for several minutes. And like you, Lionel, I was surprised that the reaction wasn't immediate. Maybe we'll find out there were communication problems there. And as you say, maybe that took just a little bit of zip off his sprint. But, you know, obviously with the hindsight of him having not won, and having seen the sprint with Van Aert and seeing how easily, in inverted commas, Van Aert was able to sort of distance him in those first few pedal strokes, you know, you do think this is going to be a hard race for him to win, because he's up against, and I think it was in our Flanders or San Remo Arrivé episode, I mentioned the statistic about the average weights of riders in all of the monuments, and Paris-Roubaix, you're looking at riders who are, on the whole, they are 75 kilos and above. And Pogacar is a real anomaly even to be taking part in Paris-Roubaix at the weight that he's at, even if he has supposedly bulked up a little bit. And, you know, he's going to come up against, well, if it's not Van der Poel or Van Aert, then it might be a Mads Pedersen or someone of that ilk. And as good a sprinter as he is, and I definitely didn't think that he had no chance in that sprint. He's beaten Van Aert in sprints before. But you feel that it's often going to be a sort of 20-80 scenario. And it's going to be very difficult because, you know, the alternative is that he drops everyone on the flat. Well, there again, you're talking about a guy who weighs 66 kilos, dropping the best classics riders in the world, with the best bike handlers in the world, who can put out the most watts. And it does start to feel a little bit like Mission Impossible. Of course it's not, but it's going to be very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, if you say that Van der Poel and Van Aert are heavyweights, do you know your boxing divisions, Daniel? What would Pogacar be? Welterweight? He's not a lightweight, really, is he?
Middleweight, light middleweight. Cruiserweight? What's cruiserweight? Cruiserweight, no, that's between, and I don't know, we're out of our depth here. Boomers don't. We don't understand cycling or boxing.
Oh dear. Does Pogacar come back and do it again?
Yes. Bad news. One of the notes I made to myself today. A bad day for RCS Sport. For the Giro d'Italia, because every time he has to come back to Paris-Roubaix, that decreases the likelihood that he's going to go back to the Giro d'Italia.
Yeah, but he's not going to give up on this until, you know, he's comprehensively beaten or
until they've moved it to Switzerland. It's called Paris-Roubaix.
Haute Alps.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what's Paul Sexas like on the cobbles?
Well, do you know what? I was talking to someone this weekend. Obviously, there'll be more about Paul Sexas and his exploits in the Tour of the Basque Country in the podcast this week. But I was talking to someone who knows him very well, and they sort of raised the conspiratorial finger and said, "Ah, and you know, he loves the pavé."
I mean, let's go back to the beginning again and just kind of try to sum up, contextualise where this edition sort of sits. I mean, am I at risk of this sort of recency bias, the fact that I've been on the edge of my seat for 5.25 hours? Was it as good as I felt it was as it unfolded? I mean, I think my heart rate probably tells me it was. There was, like I say, no moment to take a nature break of my own. I feel very hungry now. I haven't eaten enough today. And that's all because it was so absorbing. And I suppose if there was one sort of small letdown, it was that we didn't see the kind of the final flurry of blows in that last 25, 30 kilometres. Nothing happened. Mont-Saint-Pével, Carrefour de l'Arbre. It would have been good to have seen something.
Yeah, it lacked a final twist.
Maybe we'd have seen that if the gap had been a bit closer and there'd have been a bit more urgency to make sure that the Van der Poel group didn't come back. We might have seen some real fireworks. But, I mean, I'm complaining here that, I don't know, the Beatles only did 5 encores.
There you go. Yeah, it lacked one final appearance from the wardrobe monster, didn't it? The music was very threatening. But yeah, I think if you were going to sort of anoint your perfect Paris-Roubaix, you'd maybe take from kilometre or minus 130 to minus 50 of this one and bolt on the last 50 of another edition.
And just lastly, because I don't want to revisit this debate just now, we'll do it another time, or I might address it in an edition of the 1101 Cappuccino. This thing about that cycling and what it delivers, and you know, we talked a lot, Daniel, didn't we, about the storytelling aspects of cycling. Now, from my point of view, we got 5.5 hours of solid entertainment without a moment to take our eyes off the screen. But as I sort of hinted at, if you'd switched on for the sort of traditional last hour and a half, you might have been rather underwhelmed by the spectacle, not aware of all of the drama that had, you know, that happened in the first two-thirds of the race. And, you know, it did make me think. I was reflecting a lot on this, you know, how does cycling, you know, attract an audience of people, younger people who perhaps are experiencing shorter attention spans than us oldies.
Boomers.
And yet, we're not boomers yet, Daniel. Well, we can't be boomers. We can't actually be boomers. We can only be boomers in spirit, I suppose. But, you know, this was a kind of a war and peace epic, and but it was consisted of TikTok moments. And I think there's a real sort of tricky balance here for the sport of professional cycling. You know, there was so much drama and excitement, so much incident, so many competing storylines. But how do you convince people, you know, to sit down? Come on, guys, buckle in. There's just 4¾ hours of solid entertainment remaining. Don't take your eyes off it. But that's what cycling delivers. That is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. If you can't sell today's edition of Paris-Roubaix or de France, then you're never going to be able to sell it, are you? Really? I mean, that is, it had the most recognizable names, bar one or two. It had a constant drip of drama, and it had, again, a result that was full of sort of emotional gravity as well. It was really sort of the perfect. Again, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? Or last week, Tour of Flanders. That would have been the absolute ideal scenario for the Tour of Flanders organisers. Same applied for Paris-Roubaix 2 weeks prior to that. And it just underlines again that the product at the moment is pretty much exactly what those particular individuals, those particular stakeholders, the organisers would desire. It's hard to improve upon it, really. And if you can't attract people, young people, new audiences at the moment, then maybe the delivery method is the only problem, because the product itself is really quite hard to improve at the moment.
It's also got a catchy new name, which all the kids will love, Paris-Roubaix Haute de France. And just to steal a gag from our friend and colleague Rob Hatch, maybe they should have just renamed it Game of Stones, and that would attract a whole new viewer to the excitement of Paris-Roubaix.
Yeah, we'll get this line. You know that sex ass, you know what it actually means, the etymology of sex ass? It means stones, little stone.
Well, there we are.
There we go.
Next year, maybe.
Yeah.
Once he's won the tour.
Lionel, anything else? Any other performances you'd like to mention? Again, you know, this is sort of right on the whistle, so we're still sort of digesting things. And as we always say with Paris-Roubaix, it's very difficult to know exactly how everyone's day has gone. And there will be some great stories that will come out in the wash in the next few days. Everyone's race is a sort of an epic odyssey in this particular event, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Jasper Stuyven, a word for him, because he was very smart, took the best result that he could possibly have hoped for, really, in that finale. I mean, he had probably the quietest, the smoothest of rides of all of the riders up there, perhaps, although he did have at least one mechanical problem. He was out of position at one stage, I remember. I think probably just to commend everybody for another of the great cliches of Paris-Roubaix is just keep going. Everyone just keep riding forwards.
Hugs and cuddles at the finish and participation trophy for everyone.
I don't mean in that sense. I mean in the sense that no one gave up. I mean, even Filippo Ganna, I mean, talk about luck. I mean, if the same incidents had happened to him at completely different times, he might have been all right. It was just a sort of treble whammy of when those problems were that really cost him, because, you know, he was in a pretty good position at that point with the Van der Poel group. And I think they were calm. They were trying to keep it under control. And I think they probably had a better chance of making it back if Ganna hadn't punctured and then crashed and then been ruled out of sort of final contention. But really, it was just a case of one of those days where I was kind of braced for a real confusing finale where, I don't know, Mick van Dijk suddenly came up the outside as it all came back together. And then we'd be talking about, you know, how on earth did he win that? And all of the things we've talked about would almost have been relegated to subplots, whereas, you know, the reality is that it was the puncture for Pogacar, it was the punctures for Van der Poel, which really, completely shaped the race.
Yeah, and I suppose we should also, just as a footnote, or my final footnote, you know, a lot will be said about the role that luck has played today, but it would be disingenuous to put all of these punctures down to bad luck and misfortune. You know, when we live in a world where teams for weeks and months, and in some cases even years before Paris-Roubaix, are vaunting or extolling the virtues of their latest sort of their latest tire compound or whatever, and talking to us about how puncture resistant they are and so on and so forth. And then we also, you know, you see the variation in the lines that some of the riders are taking, and there's no exact science. You can't say that if you ride on the crown you're not going to get punctures, if you ride on the gutter you are, and vice versa. But certainly there are riders who take more risks, I would suggest, with their equipment than others. So you will never know with any certainty which of those punctures, which of those misfortunes today were due to some degree to rider recklessness, but there is a degree of that. There is a degree of that, that you can improve your chances of having good luck by choosing certain equipment and riding in a certain way. Otherwise, the teams would not even think about those factors.
And especially the trade-off between the speed and the watts that you can save by running certain tyre pressure. But that increases the possibility of punctures, especially on the stones of Paris-Roubaix, where, you know, they're not smooth. And you're asking the bike to deal with the crown of the road, slightly off to the edge, big potholes, gravel, muddy puddles. In the case of Van der Poel at one point, they're putting the equipment under such pressure, just the speed they're riding as well. You know, one jolt at the wrong angle, a wheel turning slightly and hitting a stone at the wrong angle, and you know, that it's luck, but it's also a consequence of choosing the bikes, setting up the bikes for speed and efficiency rather than avoiding punctures. Yeah,
you've hit the nail on the head there, because we've just seen the fastest ever edition. I think we are pretty sure it's the fastest ever edition of Paris-Roubaix
over a kilometre an hour.
So all of the technological advancement pretty much is directed towards increasing the speed. And if you look at the number of punctures and the number of mechanical problems there were today, I would suggest that will not have been very different from editions 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So yes, there have been huge technological advancements, but the teams choose to deploy them in the name of making their riders faster, not having less, in inverted commas, misfortune.
I'm sure AI could work out the sweet spot, couldn't it? You know, what is the sweet spot?
Yeah,
I haven't got time to do that now.
No, and we're not allowed to use AI. Did you see, Lionel, incidentally, was something that I wholeheartedly approved of. The L'Equipe journalists, about a week ago, this is slightly off topic, very off topic, as could only happen in France, the L'Equipe journalists have sort of their own union, and the union of L'Equipe journalists wrote a letter of complaint to L'Equipe, their bosses, about the use of AI, and saying that the members of the union had been lobbying for a charter about the use of AI for several months now, if not more than several months, a year or so. And their appeal for such a thing to come into being, to exist, have not been heeded. And the employees of L'Equipe, journalists and designers and so on, in this case, I think it was an AI-generated graphic. And the journalists made their displeasure known about this. As I said, that was slight tangent, but I thought very interesting. And we are in France. We're talking about Paris-Roubaix, a race that's sort of owned by L'Equipe
Maybe one day there'll be an AI edition of Paris-Roubaix. Everyone will love, because it's new and at the cutting edge of technology.
Yeah, and everyone
not us, of course.
And everyone will be cuddling at the end. I think that's about it. There'll be more to mop up from Paris-Roubaix, as there always is in our regular episode, in a couple of days' time. I'll also be reporting back from the birth of a star, a French cycling star in the Basque Country. Paul Seixas winning the Tour of the Basque Country. I've just got back from there. I was there most of the week, so I'll be reporting back on that. And we'll also be looking forward to the Ardennes, again in inverted commas, classics, or starting with Amstel, then the real Ardennes classics, Flèche and Liège.
And of course, there will be an episode of Arrivé very shortly, recapping Paris-Roubaix Femmes with Rose Manley and Denny Gray. So listen out for that. And yeah, we'll be back in midweek, won't we, Daniel?
We will indeed. Thank you very much, Lionel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.